So the next speaker will be Klaus
Montanen
from Finland.
Yes, hello, my name is Klaus Montanen. I represent not only INES, the International Network of Engineers and Scientists for Global Responsibility, but also the Finnish INES member organization, Technology for Life, Tekniikka elämää palvelemaan, Tekniikka ni livet, GEMS. My topic tonight is a more specific one. It's not a projection into the future, but telling you exactly of the situation as it is today and as it has been in the history. Namely, I will talk about the environmental impact of military activities. When we think about the effects of the use of weapons in conflicts, of course, we know, apart from the enormous costs in human lives and in human values, also the environment is destroyed to a large extent. Nowhere has this been more clear than in Europe as a consequence of the Second World War. If we think about the weapons of mass destruction that we have today, of course, which are much more effective than that were available 60 years ago, then the threat of nuclear war is still the most radical threat that affects us. Climate change can destroy this planet within 100 years perhaps, but a nuclear war can destroy it within half an hour. And this is something that we should still keep in mind, although there has been disarmament among nuclear weapons, but there are still enough of them to destroy human life as we know it on this globe. And also there is a threat of nuclear proliferation, new nuclear states, which will not have as high a threshold against using them, against each other. So it's good to remember that the impetus for developing the computer models for the global circulation that are now used by the IPCC and others to predict the future climate, the impetus was given by the studies of large-scale nuclear wars, the nuclear winter studies, 25 years ago. And nowadays, of course, there has been exchange. The climate studies have improved the computer models, and now we can make more realistic studies of nuclear winter. And that's, of course, even a regional nuclear war, we can say with certainty today, will have major climatic environmental effects. It will, and especially if this war is being fought with low yield so-called primitive nuclear weapons used against not hard military targets but against megacities, then we will see certainly a catastrophic drop, not an increase, in global temperature for a scale of 10 years. Now, this is not against climate change, because also this will bring lots of carbon dioxide into the air. It is the suit that lowers the temperature, but when the suit is washed out, the carbon dioxide from these huge fires will remain, and we are just worse off. But I will not go in more detail into nuclear winter. And also, you can call emissions those trails of aeroplanes that you see in the sky, also over Copenhagen, on the few clear days you have every year. Namely, the contrails and the cirrus clouds created by the contrails. Then, of course, there are oil spills, pollutions, destruction of environment in exercise areas and shooting ranges, lost ships and aircraft with ammunition on board. As you well know, in the Mediterranean there are nuclear weapons, in Greenland there are nuclear weapons coming from B-52s who have had accidents. There is a dumping of surplus ammunition and chemical agents, something that is now also a topical subject, because in the Baltic, with the plans of building this pipeline from Russia to Germany. But now let me go to these emissions, but I should remark that I will only talk about emissions from direct activities going on. I will not include emissions indirectly caused by the production of arms or ammunition and of other supplies that are needed and used by the military. And this mainly because it's very hard to get reliable data on this, but also so it is very hard to get an estimate of that, but you should keep in mind that this will at least double the figures that I will talk about here. I will take as model countries three NATO countries, one small country, Netherlands, one intermediate country, already a nuclear power country, the United Kingdom, and then the superpower, the United States. There is an onus on countries that have signed the Kyoto Protocol to declare their emissions, including their military emissions. So from the two first countries, I have quite accurate figures. If we take the Netherlands as an example of a small NATO country, in 2005, all the military activities produced something like 600,000 tons of carbon dioxide, and that is only 0.3% of the total emissions of the Netherlands. This is a typical figure to keep in mind. And I would say that this also applies to neutral countries like Sweden and Finland. The United Kingdom, again, is using, well, of all the carbon dioxide emissions in the United Kingdom, about 1% come from military activities. That is some 2 million tons, 2 megatons of carbon dioxide. And these are official Ministry of Defense figures. Now, when we go to the superpower, then the United States, since the United States is not publishing these figures, I have tried to estimate them from the known figures of the fuel use of the United States Army and armed forces. And we should remember that this is now a country fighting two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And of course, also the United Kingdom is involved in conflict. So I estimate that something like between 1.7 and 2% of the United States total carbon dioxide emissions come from these ongoing military activities. Interestingly enough, of this 75%, three quarters come from mobility fuel, that means fuel for aircraft, ships and vehicles. And the US military is the single largest oil consumer in the world today. And out of the mobility fuel, the one that has the greatest effect for many reasons, and I'll come back to that, is jet fuel. 58% of this mobility fuel is actually jet fuel. So it means that it's over 40% of the total energy use of the US military comes from flying around with jet fighters. And when I say 2% perhaps, but this doesn't sound much, but these 2% are deposited in a very sensitive area just by these jet aircraft at high altitudes. And especially one has been discussing about the effects of the nitrogen oxides. I mean, the figures I mentioned, everything has been converted to carbon dioxide equivalent, so those include also nitrogen oxides, methane, sulfur oxides and things like that. But these, when nitrogen oxides are released at heights of between 8 and 12 kilometers, they trigger the formation of ozone, which is a greenhouse gas. Of course, you may say that, oh, this helps the depletion of the ozone layer and reduces ultraviolet radiation down here. That's correct. But ozone itself is a potent greenhouse gas that leads to climate warming. On the other hand, ozone destroys methane. So methane that is escaping to high altitudes will be destroyed by this. So the combined effect, by is agreed by scientists, is still a positive one, that ozone at high altitudes will give a positive forcing to the atmosphere. Talking about aircraft emissions, which are both in the Netherlands, United Kingdom, and in the United States, perhaps the single largest component of their energy use. We should keep in mind that the transportation sector, in all, according to the IPCC, contributes some 13% to the all greenhouse gas emissions. And out of this, 12% comes from aviation, compared to road transport, that is 80%. And so 8% is then from shipping, railroads, another force of transport. So remember these figures as well. Road transport is by far the single most important factor. And that means that that aviation consumes roughly 2% of all fossil fuels burned. IPCC, in a study on aviation that is already almost 10 years old, concluded that a third of all aviation activity is military. And so if I combine these figures with this 30% and the total emission from aviation, it come again to roughly 1% of carbon dioxide emissions come from military aviation. So this is consistent. So to conclude, I can say that 1% and 2%, those are still big numbers if you measure them in millions of tons of carbon dioxide. And they are, as I said, deployed in a very sensitive area of the globe. But we should keep in mind that this is perhaps still not the most important factor. Road transport, using your own private car, is by far more dangerous than what the military is doing with their jet fighters as far as carbon dioxide emission. It is still a significant figure, and we should, of course, it is a completely unnecessary emission factor. Why? For an activity that certainly brings us no good. Finally, I should thank, this is a result of a study that Technology for Life, just for the interest, we were just curious on getting these figures straight, how large are these numbers. My conclusion is a little bit positive for once. This is perhaps not the worst thing that is happening. There are other things that are worse. But still keep in mind, the danger of nuclear wars can change these things. Any major conflict anywhere in the world can change these numbers. And I should add that in the years of the Gulf War, for instance, and the Desert Storm operation, the figures for the military activity were significantly higher. I mean, these figures that I mentioned are so-called normal peacetime activities, apart from those activities that are going on now. I mean, my figures were from 2008, so they're not going on now in Iraq and Afghanistan. Thank you.
You know, the last speaker is bringing together peace activism, environment activism, and scientific research. Joachim is a biologist. He's working for the IPCC. He's one of the 2,500 scientists supporting the development of the IPCC reports. He's a member of the ENES Council. He was for many years the leading person in Friends of the Earth, and he was engaged in the peace movement since, I know him, since more than 20 years. Joachim, now it's your floor. I think you go down to the PowerPoint presentation, and he will also speak about the relation between climate change and war.
Joachim. See, that's right. The orbit goes down. So we have to go down here. First, Rainer has introduced you to the journal that we have. I want to say that this is a journal where we have regular information about scientific research and politically relevant insight from the science and peace research movement, and it's called Global Responsibility because it addresses both peace and sustainability issues. So for instance, we had some contributions from our previous speaker in the last volume, and we also have, for example, this case from Darfur in there. So you're welcome to download it, not only to download it. It's an open source journal, it's a free subscription, so make sure your university library or your club library have a copy, and then you have always up-to-date information
on the wonderful,
wonderful things we are doing in research.
What is its title again, please?
The title is Global Responsibility. You're going to find it on the ENES homepage, which was mentioned earlier. So, I have used the title for my presentation, The Risk of Caution. Because what we see at the moment is that everybody, although we have some 30 copies there, the rest is getting from the internet. What we see today is that the insight in the need to act has grown over the last 30 years to a point that governments and business now realize that they must do something. And so they have decided to do too little too late. So what is being visible at the moment is for the first time really the insight that we need more than symbolic action, but at the same time the caution we should not overburden business. We cannot have additional debt at a time where we have spent so much money on saving banks. And banks are so much more important than the world. That is caution in terms of social and economic impacts, which is synonymous to completely underestimating the social and economic impact of climate change. Right? Climate change is going to have significant impact on what people, government people, simply tend not to understand, and also many business people tend not to understand, is that this is not something where they can do something now and something next week and something more maybe next month, and if it turns out it was not yet enough, they put an additional little measure on top of the rest of it, and then it's fine. Fine-tuning in the last minute. They don't understand that what they are playing with is a full set of boomerangs, and they're throwing the boomerang now, and they will not be able to change its course while it's flying until it hits them. And they're throwing a fresh boomerang every day. And they still live with the illusion they could convince the boomerang to fly a different course while it's over there by doing something here. So that it's out of reach, that the greenhouse gas in the atmosphere cannot be convinced by a political majority decision, it should behave differently. Ask them. At the moment, the governments here in Copenhagen are about to decide that the carbon equivalent emissions which are just being prepared and which will lead to a temperature increase of about 4 degrees, should only affect the world by 1.5 degrees. Tell that to CO2. All leaders of the world have agreed. How can it not fall in line with that? It's sometimes difficult for people who are making laws every day, and some in business make their own laws,
it's difficult to explain to them that the laws of nature are not up to be manipulated by them. They manipulate everything, so why not that? But physics is a very cruel cooperation
club. It's not democratic.
Yeah. It's not willing to compromise. So it's really not really a political person. So that is, when we talk about the risk of caution, it means they are tending to err on the wrong side, and they don't understand the mechanism of delays which is inherent to any complex system. Which is a bit of a bad sign, because business people and politicians are managing complex systems. If they don't understand the dynamic, this is a good reason to be worried. So my hypothesis is that our resource consumption, we as Europeans, even more so the North Americans, also the East Europeans, have per capita, cannot be generalized on the global level, because it's neither socially nor environmentally sustainable. And therefore, it poses a risk to international peace. The point is that as long as resources are plentiful, their distribution can be a matter of dispute, but not a matter of deep existential fighting, unless you get good substitutes. For example, when we started this little meeting, there was first a scarcity of resources in terms of place in the room. And there was no substitute for that at the moment. So you could immediately have a little fight between those inside and those outside.
Yes.
Who would have the opportunity to listen. The solution was to move that to another area, to another arena here. And there is a number of preconditions for that to work. For example, we had to have a key to get in, so opportunities must not be locked. Secondly, we had to have an equal sharing. If we had left in one half and the other outside in the cold, it would not have been very fair. Thirdly, it must be adequate infrastructure. Because if half of you had to stand and the other half could sit on chairs, that also would not be very convenient or fair. Or we would change every 5 minutes, but that would undermine the effectiveness of the lectures, I suppose. Or everyone taking someone on his knees, which might... be interesting depending on the relation and distribution of weight on the upper and the lower level. So you can see that finding an optimal solution is not easy, and the less you have resources to build up a solution, the more you run into conflict. And the problem then is, there is no substitute for a benign climate. There is no substitute for water. There is no substitute for soil, there is no substitute for biodiversity, which means we are dealing with resources which are all threatened by climate change. Because losing soil quality and losing biodiversity, both are fields where climate change is not yet the most important driver, but will become the most important one within the next 20 years. So we are organizing a multi-front attack on humankind, at the same time not building up our defense lines, because we're doing nothing to prevent loss of biodiversity, we're not consequently fighting desertification, and so forth and so forth. So we're getting the problem sharper and sharper, and it's a problem of absolute scarcities, and that is a big problem. This is the second big problem, because our decision makers are used to think in terms of scarcity, because they are all educated economists. Any economists in here? Dare to show up. So you see, it's a small minority here, a small radical minority in politics, but they have the hegemony over the brains of decision makers. And economics tells you that if something is not scarce, it's not valuable. Huh? Only when it becomes scarce, it's going to get traded and get a price. Which means biodiversity, as long as it's plentiful, is no value, and when we begin to lose it, it becomes valuable. So maybe the best method to enhance the value of nature is destroying it. Well, that is a kind of logic, and we don't have to buy into that logic, but this logic drives decision making. And this logic also means that if we talk about scarcities, the idea of scarcities is that the whole life consists of managing scarcities. When you go shopping, you make a decision, what is your priority? Do you want that bottle of milk or that bottle of wine? You want to keep the money in your pocket? So it's priorities. The priorities is because it's scarce resources. But all these resource discussions are based on the assumption that scarcities are relative scarcities. Which means, on the national level, if you have a certain amount of oil, fruit, vegetables, whatever, and there is more demand for it than is being supplied, then you pay more. When you pay more, then there is enough again. That is a wonderful invisible hand of the market regulating demand and supply, bringing it to equilibrium. Nobody has ever seen that hand, but some have felt its elbow from time to time. Very tangible one. But this is then the idea that it brings things to an equilibrium again, because scarcities are always relative. The problem is that no economic theory and no model is in place and existing which helps us to deal with absolute scarcities. And ruining the climate as it stands is bringing an absolute scarcity of survival conditions in climate terms. And as I said, in soil, in biodiversity, in marine livability due to the acidification of the oceans, and so forth. So this is creating a situation where the current tools of policy making systematically fail to help. And all our decision makers simply rely on these tools, these models, these concepts, these mental models and these computer models. And it's like, most of you have had some mathematics in school, when you have discussing a curve and you have something with a quotient which is dividing through something which is going close to zero. And at that point the curve isn't defined, it goes into eternity. And exactly that is a point where the same thing is happening with economic models when you have absolute scarcities. So that is where the model simply doesn't work. That means our decision makers, we have seen that in the economic crisis, they were shocked. Their models had failed. They began to rethink everything for about 6 weeks. And then they found they are in an out-of-world situation which is not explained by their theory, and they want to escape from that, and they're not talking about exit plans. And the exit plan means they want to go back to normality. I've seen that in the newspapers. Financial Times, Economist, particularly those, but also the normal dailies. They want to get back to normality. Which means, plainly speaking, they want to invest some trillion of US dollars to recreate the situation which brought about the crisis. Great investment. Because we should have learned that this old model didn't work, and it's not only nitty-gritty elements which have to be fixed, but that the basic philosophy behind it was wrong. We should have learned that accumulating debt can work for some time, but sooner or later the bubble bursts, and then it's more expensive than anything what we have done before would have done beforehand. And that is, of course, true for the environmental debt just as well. But we didn't learn that lesson. The lesson we learned is borrow some billions from the taxpayer and give it to the banks. Hope they are happy. Yeah? As Greenpeace said, if the world had been a bank, it would long have been saved. So, the model we have, that is my hypothesis, the current model we have, our consumption and production model, is not sustainable. We are dealing with absolute scarce resources. We are squandering them in the north, we are leaving not enough in the development of the south, and we are creating a situation which poses an international risk to peace and a risk to international peace. And as Jürgen already said, this is as well a risk between countries as in particular within countries. I say alternatives are possible, but these alternatives need two elements. They need to combine efficiency and sustainability policy on the national level. Don't think that efficiency is a solution. Efficiency is always the amount of resources per something, per GDP, per something. Efficiency is never an absolute limit. Efficiency is a cornerstone of the concept of relative scarcity. Be efficient with relatively scarce resources. For absolutely scarce resources, the demand is not be efficient, but limit the consumption. There are absolute limits. Right? That is a different concept. So, sustainability on the national policy and peace policy in international relations are the two things which must go together, because without a peace policy, we will not have the limited time and the resources and the resources of goodwill to go forward. My fear is, and I can read that out, humankind may just be sacrificing the possibility of future generations to live a decent life. And don't forget, climate change lasts 1,000 to 5,000 years. So it is not that it's irreversible, you see. You just have to be a bit patient.
Well, I'm glad to see it.
Well, that's from some of my colleagues who think that the world things could be over. It's just like the ozone layer. That was a really short-term phenomenon of a few hundred years. So it's not that much of a worry. You're young, you have time. Yeah, so we don't talk about irreversible problems, but we need a bit of patience. And I understand if the Pope is not that much involved. Catholic Church tends to survive centuries. Other organizations should be more worried. So, just to illustrate another big misunderstanding. Some people used to say climate change, that is gradual warming of the earth, that's not that bad. It will lead to much better red wine in some areas which now, like the UK, have a problem with that. Well, that is not the whole story, as we know. So just some pictures to illustrate what is coming. There is flood waves. I hope you can recognize that. 7 to 8 meter high flood waves. I sit down so you can see better from there. In Mississippi, USA. That is storms, typhoons. I just had the pleasure to enjoy the latest typhoon in Manila, which was a few, 2 months ago, when part of the city was flooded. There I learned one important lesson. It is not only the number and the strength of typhoons, it was a very weak one, but a very wet one. It is also something which has to do with the timing and the social conditions. Because vulnerability is always a combination of the structure, the exposure, how are you living, the weather, what is really happening, but also the capability of local communities to deal with that. And the part of the city where I was absolutely dry. It was raining, okay, but it was not flooded. But the area which was flooded with those people who were the poorest city dwellers, who had built their kind of huts on the land which was cheapest because it was flooded from time to time. So the misery of these people was multiplied by the storm, but was misery beforehand. It was hitting the weakest most. And they had the least resources to deal with that. So that is one of the reasons, because the weakest are always most hit by this. One of the contributions to the risk of internal tensions and conflicts between those who weathered off climate change relatively comfortably with a lot of infrastructure, protective measures and whatever, and those who are directly exposed to its impact. Secondly, the timing is very important. This storm was not that strong that you would have said it has a major impact on the world rice yield. But in certain regions, first there and later on in North Vietnam, it came exactly in that period of rice harvesting where the water is off the rice paddies. And when they are swamped, then the harvest is lost. So it's dependent very much on the timing in a certain kind of region of the agricultural activities. The same thing can be rather harmless or completely devastating. And that means the projections that we have, or the cost projections, are not worth the paper they are written on. It's simply these very detailed local effects which really make the heavy suffering for people. But I wanted not to take too much, but to show pictures. So that's tomorrow's normality. I hope you can recognize the flooding water. It's happening in all continents. That is in Africa.
but also in Europe. This is a nice photograph from...
Which part of Africa?
Oh, that was Eastern Africa somewhere. And this is a nice photograph because you probably can't read it. The poster here is from a local energy supply company who was advertising renewable energies, and it reads, "Here, water power is redirected towards you." Yeah, it was too much of a good thing. As I said, it's not only the direct climate effect. This is areas in the world which are affected by 3 degrees temperature change in loss of biodiversity. And you see it's almost all populated areas for different reasons. You see that ecosystem services are undermined. This is a mangrove forest in the Red River Delta, freshly planted by the government to protect the country against cyclones and storms. And this is lost, also endangered by climate change. I talk about absolute scarcities. You know, that is the gun which is threatening national economies today. The most dangerous gun ever pointed at national economies, the oil gun. And the problem then is that we all know that peak oil is going to come. Everybody agrees about that in the meantime, even the International Energy Agency. The only question is when. Has it already happened? Some people say 2006 was peak oil, other people say it's 2010, not that far away, 2020. But I haven't heard recently any estimate which was later than 2025. On the other hand, the Hirsch report to the US government said that, well, when it's going to come, our economies can adapt to no or low fossil fuel availability situation. But they need significant restructuring. This restructuring will take enormous investments. Hope we can afford that now that the banks have to be safe. But on the other hand, it will also take time. And they said the time it takes will be 10 to 15 years. So if 2025, by the latest, this peak oil is going to come and we need 15 years, maybe we shouldn't wait much longer. So the whole world has gone mad. Everybody talks, as you can see on the left-hand side, about financing, and nobody understands on the right-hand side that we are undermining our civilization. So that can lead to emerging conflicts. The first one is about scarcities between countries. That's about the oil conflict. See, that's a cartoon from the 1970s. You recognize that from the very modern styling of the cars. It's not very hip, but it shows that there is a certain tradition in hunting the oil. And, of course, they look like a conflict. Secondly, the question is, how are resources being divided up again? It's maybe a bit relaxing that we now have an American president who is a Peace Nobel Prize winner and has promised to send troops only if really necessary. As compared to the previous one who would send troops whenever he felt there was someone who had not been nice to Delhi. So the question is, if you see the official statements, we could not leave that country alone, it's swimming on oil. So the question was whether it was a war for oil or whether they wanted just to secure the oil for the next wars. I'm not exactly sure because we heard just from Klaus that they need a lot of oil for all these wars. Yeah, he works in both sides of the electric. But the question is, the big game from the 19th century was starting again, in particular in the Central Asian region, and it's not yet completely over. And the question is, do the big countries try to divide up the world again? And the answer is yes. But it works a slightly different way than it used to work in the past. First of all, Germans have no gunships anymore. That's helpful because that started the First World War, and this time we're only going to join the Americans but not do our own one. Secondly, the point
is that in the past, the argument used to be that countries should secure their excessive resources via deregulation at the global market. So secure access to oil wells, have free open borders and a free trade in oil. However, that game ceases to function. Today, the big oil companies are controlling a significant share of the oil trade, but only about less than 20% of the oil in the ground. The majority of oil is owned by national state-owned companies in the oil-possessing countries. So that is why Georgie, the youngest, said that they are sitting on our oil. So that means there was also a number of complaints from the United States that China does not buy its resources on the world market, but tries to make direct delivery contracts with the resource-producing nations, which is the most intelligent thing you can do, I think. Because, as we have seen, for example, in the last oil price crisis in 2008, the food crisis, the promise that a deregulated free market would provide at all times with sufficient supply at fair prices is an illusion. So those who have a direct contract and delivery for a long time, delivery contract which for the long view, those are better off because they have a reliable contract. Whereas their partners in those countries are also better off because they have also a reliable source of income. Not very much this year and very little next year. So that essentially calls for a cooperation between countries instead of leaving it to the market. So, as being an economist, I'm not against markets because markets create a certain efficiency when it comes to the allocation of goods according to purchasing power. But not all things should be allocated according to purchasing power, and other things, on the other hand, markets need a political framework. Next problem we're going to have besides that is water. It's the photo from Lima. Lima, about 10 million inhabitants, all dependent on water. And it's going to be gone in the next 15 years. So if that happens, what happens with about 1 to 2 billion people dependent on glacier water? And then it's not only a question whether they are migrants or what, or whether they are willing to go to a better place, then there's simply no opportunity for survival in the place where they are. And then things get tricky. The next question that we have is food. If soil fertility is being reduced, as you see in the lower photo, and if we have a permanent decrease of the available fertile soil in the north, because we are degrading our soils, the question is about the long-term food supply. So that's what I said, vulnerability is exposure, sensitivity, and adaptive capacity. And that is, I think, where the Millennium Development Goals come in, where strengthening the institutional setting in third world countries come in, but also flexibilization of the institutional capacities in our countries. As we heard from the United States, they were not prepared for a major disaster. And the same can happen in European countries as well. So climate change impacts cause stress. If they act on fragile societies already suffering from other stress factors, then confrontation, civil wars, and wars become more probable. That is what Jürgen already went into some more detail. And the shocking thing to me was which countries are thought to be under risk. Some of the BRICS countries, you know, BRICS, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, so the emerging economies, which are the core of the G20. So India, Russia, and South Africa was considered at risk. High population countries like Indonesia, traditional conflict regions like Israel and the Arab world, and large part of sub-Saharan Africa. And the question is whether what Jürgen has explained, that humankind has a real chance between conflict over resources or collaboration to deal with resources,
whether that works out in a situation of absolute scarcity, when there is nothing to distribution. So, because that external pressure will make common solutions more and more difficult, but at the same time more and more important. You probably all know the impact of climate change raises numbers of species extinction and things like that. So, it's only to illustrate that the temperature change which is going on has already increased significantly the pressure on humankind in our societies. If we had acted when we first recognized it, 1 degree would have been unavoidable. But that was in the late 1970s, early 1980s. Already that would have meant that we have ignored water for more than 100 years. We didn't do it. Now 2 degrees are more or less unavoidable, even if we take radical measures. And that means what is between 1 and 2 degrees is the responsibility of those who decided for the last 20 years not to act. And what is here between 2 and 4 degrees is the responsibility of the leaders today in Copenhagen when they decide not to act. You can hold them responsible for hundreds of thousands of victims because it has been known. On top of that come the tipping points, just mentioning them briefly. You know, tipping points is when we go beyond certain thresholds and a sudden change of the system character happens. The latest projections I have seen was 0.5 meter sea level rise by the mid and 2 meters by the end of this century already. So I will be in the lucky situation to see some of that before I die. And 10 to 20 meters then in the next centuries, because that warming is a long-term process. Can you imagine what would happen then? The Allianz Insurance Company, one of the world's biggest, calculated that 136 cities, coastal cities, above 1 million inhabitants will have to be removed or significantly relocated at costs of about $20 trillion. Inclusive this place here, well, Copenhagen, Stockholm, Helsinki, Hamburg, not that much Los Angeles and San Francisco, because that region is going to be under a desertification, so they have to leave it anyway. And New York is also a different situation because due to the flow of the water, the sea level rise in New York will be 2 meters higher. So probably they have to build pretty high walls around the city. So you don't see the towers anymore. What is the price of glaciers? It's true for 2 to 3 billion people. Floods and drought in arid regions cause hundreds of millions of disaster refugees. And the bad thing is that it's flood and humid and drought and arid regions. So whatever you have, you get more, you get too much. Biodiversity, the collapse of the Amazon and the Congo forest is foreseen. Massive loss of biodiversity, loss of hundreds of millions of people living on the forest. 1/6 of the world population these days lives on protected areas and tropical forests. And it means the collapse of the monsoon. And that, for example, means that the main basis for the current food-producing pattern in India, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Philippines, Malaysia, south of China, is lost. And you have heard about in the past the collapse of the monsoon, but it didn't come for a year. How starvation was spreading. And that is what we are playing with now. One of the boomerangs, and we're throwing it without thinking that we can never take it back. Nonlinear effects are the threshold issue. The change needed is also very simple. We have to think about all things at the same time. But the challenge in figures is maybe interesting. The IPCC has called for maximum 2 degrees, which means you have to have in mind when they say 2 degrees in global average, that means over the thumb 4 degrees over land. 4 degrees in global average means 8 degrees. Just multiply by 2. Now we know it's about 430 ppm volume considered necessary for 2 degrees, and the IOSCE countries call for about 1.5 degrees and 350 ppm. The Stern report considered 3 degrees as realistic, 66 degrees over land, and the Handley Center just published a study. Published a study which said that 4 degrees
would be acceptable. Which means, if you look at the challenge, here is, I think, the final message. We know that until 2050, we are entitled to a maximum of 600 billion tons which may be emitted if we meet with a 75% probability the 2 degrees threshold. 600 million billion tons worldwide would mean 2 tons per capita for every world citizen from now on until 2050. At current emission levels, the United States will exhaust its allowance until 2050 within 4 years, and should then emit zero for the rest 46 years. Europe will exhaust it in 8 years. What the US and the EU have suggested here in Copenhagen, its reduction plans will extend the period for the American allowance to last from 4 to 4.5 years, and for the EU from 8 to 9.5 years, out of 40. And that means, very obviously, what has been proposed by the industrialized nations here and so far will not be able to limit climate change to 2 degrees Celsius, but rather to 3 to 4 degrees Celsius. And that means all the risks we have described beforehand are willingly taken into consideration. It also means, that was my start of the presentation, that they are claiming reductions which lead to a 3 to 4 degree temperature increase while talking about 1.5 degrees, hoping that the laws of physics would listen to what they do. And all these technology for the photos from Singapore and Beijing, it have not helped to solve the solution. So what we definitely need is radical steps, but I don't see them taken, and we have to admit that the time for the pain-free turnaround has been missed. It is about cost who has to pay. The Europeans and Americans are by far not ready to pay the cost. They are obliged to due to the historical ecological. Thank you.
And thank you to all the speakers. Now you can